Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
You're welcome along to the football show. So later on we'll hear from Andy West. There is carnage in Barcelona. All hell is breaking loose in Barcelona. None of it's good. In the meantime, Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent back with us. Evening.
Hi, Joe.
Latest in the Premier League, everybody. So two games have gone full time, as I suspect you know by now. Sheffield United, 2-1 winners against West Brom, building on their win at Old Trafford not so long ago. And Arsenal staying 10th. They went to Molineux this evening and were beaten by Wolves 2-1. In the live games, it's about to go half-time at Old Trafford. Manchester United 4, Southampton 0. And Newcastle at home to Crystal Palace are trailing by 2-1. So very comfortable for Manchester United. Wan-Bissaka scored the opener on 18 minutes. Luke Shaw with the assist. Marcus Rashford scored the second on 25 minutes, Greenwood with the assist. Then there was an OG, and then on 39 minutes, Luke Shaw with his second assist of the evening. And it was Cavani with a brilliant header, one of those get-your-neck-muscles-through-it headers, lined it up from a long way out. And it's 4-0 at the break. That one's done and dusted. Crystal Palace, as I said, 2-1 up against Newcastle. Jonjo Shelvey did put Newcastle 2-1 up. And then Riederwald equalised, and Gary Cahill has put Crystal Palace 2-1 up. That all leaves, Dan, United level on points with Man City, although City have two games in hand now, so let's not get too excited, Manchester United fans, but level with City nonetheless, and a good result thus far, and Arsenal in 10th. So they're making not much progress, and Sheffield United have, in fairness, closed the gap on the other two relegation likelies in Fulham and West Brom. So it's Fulham 14 points, West Brom 12, and now Sheffield United right there on 11. However, those three are very much cut adrift from the rest. The gap from Fulham to Brighton in 17th is 7 points, and it's 10 points if you're Sheffield United. So still a long way to go there, but they're showing some signs of form.
Yeah,
there we are.
That was a good summation of it.
Thank you, Dan.
As it's quite lengthy. I wanted to come in around six times during it to like interject, but I mean, it's like Joe is just going. He's going everywhere with every game. It's like, but. Because like the Manchester United one, I mean, descending off in the second minute is the story of that game. Mm. Yankovic cut McTominay in half with an absolutely ridiculous challenge. That was game over. So like Man United 4-0 up sounds brilliant, but that's because they've been playing against 10 men since the second minute, and it's a non-event. It's a complete non-event of a game, and people will see this challenge like it's a reckless high challenge that sort of takes McTominay out in the midriff. It's a straight red card. And really, if you're Southampton, game over. So it's almost meaningless that Manchester United score. Okay, listen, playing against 10 men can be difficult. You can make hard work of it. But that is the story of that game. You know, that is the story of that game. And as a result, like, you know, I don't think you can say this is a statement or anything like that. They're very efficiently doing what you should do when an opposing player gets himself sent off in the second minute. So, I mean, that's really game plan out the window for Hasenhüttl and co, because Southampton are far better than that, and actually, you know, you would have thought they would be capable of it. Sheffield United, I mean, I'm sort of getting strangely invested in the Sheffield United story. I've watched a lot of their games, and I really think they should have far more points than they should have. And I'm sort of, I like the idea of them launching some kind of a great escape now, but they're so far back, and I watched the sort of most a good bit of the second half, and they were one down. And in fairness, they come back and won, and they're getting back a bit of that grit and, you know, sort of ability to grind out results that characterised their run last year. But they've left it pretty late. But there, yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a few sendings off in the Arsenal game too. So yeah, it's been a busy Tuesday evening, certainly.
Yeah, I see. I didn't get a chance to see much of the Arsenal game. David Luiz was sent off, and Bernd Leno. What did Luiz do? Do you know?
No, so I'm not entirely sure, because I'm all in on Sheffield United. Sheffield United have like have the Irish lads there, okay. And I'm watching them whenever they're playing, and like they've lost so many games by ridiculous sort of mistakes and errors and stuff. I find it very frustrating to watch them. So I'm not entirely sure. I think the Leno one was a bit of daftness from him, all right, but the Luiz one, I'm not entirely sure. Right. We should be getting on top of that. But there's so much happening. You know,
no, there's a lot happening. I'll check the Luiz one out before we're done. On the Southampton sending off, Alexander Yankovic, his first start for Southampton in the Premier League, and it's over after 2 minutes at Old Trafford. Did you say like studs to the midriff? Was this an accidental one?
Well, like it's one of those ones that it's actually so bad. It's like the Brentford one recently. Actually, not really like the Brentford one, but it's almost so bad that you can only assume like that there was no intent there to do it. You know, like, I mean, if someone had gone out to do someone and did what he did, you would assume that that was the mission. But it was just more like daft, reckless. And listen, if you're on the receiving end of it, like you will be outraged, you know, outraged by it. And as you mentioned, like he's a low profile enough player, so he doesn't necessarily have the people to defend him with the not that type of player line that you would get in those scenarios. So he'll probably get like more grief than he would if it was a beloved character who did it. But I mean, it's crazy stuff. Like, I mean, early in the game, you know, you maybe try and make your presence felt and get involved early doors, but he's lost control of his body basically, and everything's high, and it's not good. Like it wasn't in the era of VAR. Like you're not getting away with that, even if it's missed by the referee. Yeah. You know,
it's hard to say he's not that sort of player when this is all he's done in his 2 minutes of his career.
Yeah, the previous minute and a half, he was good as gold. You know, like it's completely out of character in the context of that. But it's I've been sort of watching a bit of the game, but to be honest, like at 2-0, it's like 2-0 against 10. This is over. Yeah. This is done, you know. So in some respects, like the fixture schedule is so relentless at the moment. This is great for Manchester United. Like everyone is struggling with the demands of the fixture list, I think. I think that's why teams are struggling for consistency. I think that's a massive factor. So to get a free pass like this, you know, to get a midweek game, get it done. I know that I don't think they play till they maybe play Everton next Monday. But like to get it done, and this is now like you shouldn't be sustaining any damage in this game. You know, it's a chance probably to rest some legs. It's one to get through.
I've just seen that's it, you know. I've just seen the tackle.
It's not. Give me your view, Joe. Yeah.
Do you know what jumped to mind a little bit? What jumped to mind a little bit was Roy Keane, Alfie Ingehalen.
That's what people are saying. But like Keane and Haaland, I mean, we know the book.
Well, we know all about Yankovic and McTominay. He's been after him since under 17s.
He stood over him when he was injured, you know, 6 years ago and said, "Oi, yeah, you can tell your mate Weatherall I'm coming after him
exactly,
too."
Exactly, for him too. It's in that ballpark. For people who haven't seen it, I'm trying to give people a reference.
I'm just watching it again now, actually. It's just being repeated again now. Yeah. It's one where McTominay sort of loses control of the ball a bit. So it's one that it gives the encouragement for the player to tackle.
Yeah.
But McTominay's that, I mean, it wasn't remarkably quick to get there. He's off to, everything's bad about it.
He goes in with his right foot high up, studs into McTominay's, I'd say, knee/thigh, and doesn't catch him fully. McTominay's probably quite relieved that he wasn't caught fully. So it's, and he went in at such pace, I mean, ferocious kind of force in it. So it could have been very nasty for McTominay. Had to be a red card, really. Sorry for someone like that. I mean, he's 19 years of age. It's his first start. I think Southampton are missing a few players this evening, and I'm sure he's very eager to make an impression and go out and make an impact on the game, and you do something like that, and it's grim. So look, he's just a kid. It's not easy.
It's around the world now. I mean, that's the thing. Like it does. It's very hard to say. Like that there's any, you know, that it does. Like it's a big night in his career. So yeah. There's nothing. There's like it's clearly not something that he set out to do. And like we are obviously in a time where like I mean I see here today Aaron Connolly closing his social media accounts off the back of grief he's getting and stick. I can imagine for a young lad, you know, a game that's watched around the world, he's going to be the subject of all sorts of stuff now. So I think there has to be that sort of that mindfulness of that.
Yeah,
in discussing.
For sure. Well, I saw a few of his teammates didn't react angrily towards him when the red card was hoisted up, or didn't even kind of turn away in disgust and say, "Oh, sod that kid, he's let us down." There was a degree of like arms around him and look, don't worry, it's okay. And, you know, it does happen, yeah. So
he could have been given a pep talk before, you know, by people, listen, go out there, get stuck in, get involved early. And, I mean, he's followed it to the letter. And it's one of those, if McTominay's studs had been equally high and they both sort of met, like, you know what I mean? It's just the body shape of each player coming into it left him exposed to doing something reckless. And as you say, like, McTominay's lucky. We're probably having a different discussion, to be fair, if he's been taken off with his, you know, with his leg in a couple of places.
Yeah. I'll just break off to go to Old Trafford and get the verdict at halftime from Peter Smith.
Manchester United 4, Southampton 0, and the tone was set after only 78 seconds when Southampton's Jankovic, on his first start, was sent off for a reckless challenge on McTominay. It took only 70 minutes for United to find an opener through Aaron Wan-Bissaka from close range. Marcus Rashford added a second with a clinical finish. There was an own goal for Jan Bednarek on 35, and then Edison Cavani headed in a fourth before the break to make it Manchester United 4, Southampton 0.
Meanwhile, St James's Park, Newcastle against Crystal Palace, also half-time there. Here's Stephen Goldsmith.
Newcastle 1, Crystal Palace 2, a cracking half of football drawn to a close at St James's. Jonjo Shelvey fired in brilliantly for the home side less than 2 minutes in, and it was all Newcastle till Palace levelled. A pile driver by Rydevald, then moments later Cahill headed home a second, and this match had been turned on its head. A shell-shocked Newcastle weathered a bit of a storm before getting back on the front foot themselves. Fraser, Almiron and Schürr have all gone close for the home side, but at the break it's Newcastle 1, Crystal Palace 2.
There we are, Dan McDonald with me. We've lots to get through here, so I'm going to jump right in.
Joe, before we get to it, the Louise red card, we should probably clear that up if people are listening to it and they're like, what's the story with the Louise red card? So he was done for a foul, it was a foul that also resulted in a penalty being awarded to Wolves, and I see Mikel Arteta has now claimed that VAR officials must have decided to send him off after viewing different angles that Arteta hadn't seen. That he's basically alleged that there's different VAR angles that they have in Stockley Park or whatever that confirmed. Because there's one of these where there's marginal contact coming into the box, and it's been, I thought that there was a triple punishment thing now, where if it's a professional foul, you don't also get the, for a penalty, you don't also get the red card. But they've clearly deemed it that it was serious enough because, the Wolves player was going straight through. So it was a pass played at pace and he sort of clipped him and he got everything. But Arteta's fuming over it and says it changed the game. So there we go. Okay. Professional foul.
A very likeable David Luiz, by the way, every time he's interviewed. He was interviewed after the United game on Saturday and just an intelligent type, I think, and thoughtful, but a bit of fun as well. Anyway, that's by the by. So you mentioned Aaron Connolly. We should just touch on that briefly. Aaron Connolly had that chance against Spurs and really should have scored, you know. It's just one of those where the defender did quite well and Connolly had any number of options and chose the one which was blockable. What we know of Connolly through his Ireland career thus far is that he's a pretty confident fella. He's not afraid on the pitch to be a bit selfish, and then he has the self-awareness and the confidence afterwards to do an interview straight away on live TV and literally say, yeah, I was a bit selfish there, I'm going to work on that. And I thought that was quite impressive that he had digested the game so quickly. I sort of didn't mind in a way, he had the confidence to take on shots, understanding, well, you know, I need to just relax that a little bit and when someone's clearly in a better position, pass them. And admitted on TV, front up on TV. So I thought that's pretty well adjusted, smart fella, and that, you know, coming from good stock there and he'll be okay. So we can probably assume that him missing that gilt-edged chance against Spurs and then promptly deleting his social media are not unconnected, which maybe gives us an insight into how grim it can get out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, this came out initially, it was the sort of the Brighton beat reporter at The Athletic sort of detailed it and looked like, you know, it had been quite well verified at the club. It even mentioned that, you know, someone at the club had been in touch with Connolly just to check if he was okay after the grief he received at the weekend. Like, as you mentioned, like, Aaron Connolly is someone who does, like, he plays with a lot of personality, you know, and at times, like, too much personality for people, you know, as in even growing up, like, you know, you watch him playing underage games and stuff. And, yeah, his decision, like, he's an incredible ability. But his decision-making is the type that would sort of drive people mad sometimes. You can imagine some of his teammates and people would be frustrated by some decisions. But it was interesting, like, you know, because, listen, he would have been dropped from an Ireland under-19 squad at some stage. But there would have been maybe some questions about his, I don't know, just like sort of aspects of maybe is how he sits into a sort of a team dynamic and sort of quite confident and maybe rub people up the wrong way sometimes. Yet what we've seen in the last sort of year or so, and you hope that he's maturing with it. Like, as you mentioned, a quite critical streak, you know, of himself, self-critical. Like, you know, that after that Finland game where it was pretty much the only game he played for Ireland in October, November, with all that happened. And he got to play through the middle and he missed chances. But he really was harsh on himself afterwards. And, like, he is having now, like, see, you can be obviously a precocious talent at underage level where you're very good and you're brilliant and you can be the king of the world because you've probably never encountered any disappointments before in your life, really. Like, it's something you'd speak about with sort of young players who've maybe had a fall, that if they get to a Premier League club at 18, 19, like, they've never coped with any kind of disappointment really in their sporting life. Because to get to that level, you're probably the best team in every team you've played in growing up. You're probably the best player in your youth team at the Premier League to get into the squad. So everything is going up, up, up and up. And what's happened with him, all of a sudden now he's having that sort of difficult second season after that brilliant start to his first season. He had a long barren run last year too, and it's probably bothering him a bit. Like, he's only scored a handful, maybe two goals this year. He's probably been reminded of that consistently. You know, there's a huge volume of people worldwide watching his every move. And listen, they can tap away at you in a heartbeat. And if you have a bad game, I don't know what it's like to be a player in that instance who probably has thousands upon thousands of followers on Twitter and Instagram, but I'm sure he gets thousands upon thousands of messages, you know, ripping the piss out of him a bit. And there was a suggestion in the story as well that a lot of this, because Brighton won the game, so it wasn't as if it was going to be a time of massive anger for their support. And there was a suggestion, a lot of the comments were maybe from gamblers who were miffed and not necessarily even Brighton fans. So, like, that's just an idiotic trend that goes with life now. If you could look at a League of Ireland result on a Friday night, if a team that shouldn't win loses, there'll be comments underneath from hundreds of punters who lost their money given off about them. Connolly obviously got a bad dose of it, but it is part of the character building process that comes with spending your life at Premier League level if he wants to stay there, that he has to, this is the stuff that you have to deal with. And it's harsh and it's not fair. And it shouldn't happen, and it's a lot of faceless idiots sending it. But it comes with the territory now, and that's not to play it down. But clearly, he's taken the action that he did, maybe to shut his mind off to it, and that's probably no bad thing.
The Gary Neville podcast, Dan, he was talking on Sunday, does a podcast after game in Sky Sports, often with Martin Tyler. They do a quick 15, 20 minutes, always pretty good. Mm. I think it's really popular as well, and Neville's always really good on it. So he was talking about the Lampard situation right towards the end, and I was listening to this and it kind of just stopped me in my tracks a little bit, the way he discussed the Lampard thing. And I mean, he was saying a lot of the usual things. Look, he wasn't surprised, and this is Chelsea, and Lampard will be a better manager for it. But then out of nowhere he said, I go back to Napoli 8 or 9 years ago when Andre Villas-Boas had picked a team in the afternoon of a Champions League game, and he left out Frank Lampard, Michael Essien and another big player at that time. And I remember Chelsea players at that time ringing up members of the media and trying to get Villas-Boas out. And Frank was part of that group.
it's an amazing thing when you, because I actually read it first rather than hearing it, if you know what I mean. And it's the thing of, like, and listen, we have a discussion here, and like, sometimes, you know, you're chatting away and you're chatting away, and then it's like, when you see it in print, it's like, whoa. You know, and it's obviously a very discursive format, and he says that. But I mean, it's a big thing to say, not an unsurprising thing to say, because I think even in discussions about Chelsea in the last while, it was pointed out that senior players of the club had a big influence when managers came and went, and it was no surprise. It was always felt that obviously Terry and Lampard were prominent in that. But that's it. It's not as if it's some journalist saying it. It's Gary Neville.
Mm. I mean, it's real, you live by the sword, Frank, territory. He wasn't, by the way, in a vindictive way saying, I've zero sympathy for Lampard and, you know, tough, whatever. He was almost making a wider point about Chelsea and saying, you know, Lampard, of all people, went in with his eyes wide open. This was the culture at Chelsea. And it's a culture, I suppose, this is me saying this, not Neville, but it was a culture Lampard in part created and shaped. He was such a dominant player there. So it was just kind of an interesting one.
AVB.
So he's resigned from Marseille. All hell is breaking loose there as well. We might talk to Philippe Auclair on the show tomorrow. In effect, Marseille signed Olivier Nitchum from Celtic against Villas-Boas' express wishes. He said, do not sign this player. I specifically am telling you, I don't want him. And so he woke up and read in the paper they'd signed him. So he said, right, I'm done. I mean, I've had enough of this. I'm done. And meanwhile, the ultras outside the training ground were peeved because Marseille and their form are going down the toilet, and they broke into the training ground and trashed it. There were several hundred ultras outside the training ground. They're 14 points behind Lyon. So that doesn't seem like much fun right now.
No, no. I've seen more than one Celtic fan sort of dryly comment that a Celtic player can get a Marseille manager sacked, but not Neil Lennon, you know, because the Chamblet couldn't even get in their side. And yet his movement has managed to have a sort of a domino effect in Ward. But it's a mad one. I mean, when you think about how Villas-Boas was spoken about when he came on the scene, like, you know, then the next Mourinho to some degree, because of his background as someone who didn't play and moved through the game in a sort of a different way. He's had a sort of a weird trajectory of his career. He was in Russia, wasn't he? And he's sort of been a bit. He's sort of one of these managers that's starting to go on the circuit. Mm. You know, he might pop up in another country for another gig, and it doesn't seem to necessarily last for a huge amount of time. Mm. It does seem like you, by the standards of managerial press conferences, for a manager to like come out and say this player has been signed against my will. I mean, clearly it's a sign that he obviously wanted out himself. I mean, unfortunately, it happens all the time now for managers that players are signed against their will. But obviously, some just grin and bear it, and others go their own way.
Deadline day was yesterday. I didn't get to see much of it. I was working elsewhere. Sky Sports have toned it down anyway. I'd say COVID put paid to any fun.
They still did their end of. They still did the 11 p.m. montage of highlights of the day, which is sort of like, you know, in times of lockdown, it's a bit like doing a review of your own day in lockdown at the end of it. Like 11, you know, took the bins out this morning, you know, here's the cup of tea. Because it really was just, rather than, as we've seen in the past, you know, there was no shots of a reporter outside a stadium with someone, you know, brandishing a sex toy over his shoulder. But there was no highlights like that to stick into it. Instead, it was more so... here's a series of shots of Sky reporters on their own giving updates from across the day, and maybe Harry Redknapp coming into it, or like it was definitely banter less, you know, it was definitely low on that, but they still managed to get it done. Harry Redknapp, I think, got lost and got caught in traffic on the way to the studio, and they managed to get something out of that. But pretty. I mean, I'm not even sure Harry missed his turn, but. To be honest, I think that ties in with the fact that the deadline day itself was a far more sober affair, because spending was down massively, and there are very obvious reasons for that and all that's going on in the world. We're talking about Barcelona later, who are broke, but obviously there's a lot of clubs at all levels of the game now who are mining their pennies, and as a result, the January splurge really. Doesn't make sense. It seemed like a lot of the business was more. I mean, Liverpool, obviously, for example, were like, you know, fixing something urgently that needed to be resolved, where there wasn't as much sort of a miscellaneous discretionary spending going on. It was more necessary stuff.
Well, we'll talk about a few moves and a few concerning Irish players. On the Liverpool front, Ben Davies signed, age 25, came through Preston's Academy, still there. And Mark Lawrenson obviously has links with both clubs, so he has seen lots of Davies. And if Liverpool fans were thinking of getting too excited that they've, you know, taken some gem, unpolished, Laro fairly shut them down. He was saying, if he'd gone to Celtic, which I'd heard had been agreed, then I was thinking he could do well there. But being honest, I don't really see him being good enough to be on Liverpool's radar. He's a real steady Eddie. He's left-footed, he's quick enough, but he's not got phenomenal pace or anything like that. He's been good in the Championship. Very good. But I've watched him and thought, up against the extra nous and quality you will get in the Premier League, on top of the extra pace, it will be a test for him. You wouldn't want to just throw him in to face Manchester City, put it that way. It's obviously a great move for him. I just can't see him getting near the first team. And he said he's a great lad. Like, this wasn't Lara taking any relish in saying any of this, but he was just dampening the sense of, we've got a centre half. The other thing is, Nat Phillips, to be fair, against West Ham, alongside Henderson, who played very well, even though that's their 12th partnership in 21 different games. Nat Phillips did okay, you know. He's not as easy on the eye or as silky smooth on the football, but he's probably making better, sounder defensive decisions, those small, tiny decisions which have you in position or out of position across the 90 minutes. So I suspect it'll be Phillips and Henderson maybe next week, but who knows what Liverpool centre halves.
We'll see. Yeah, I mean, they've obviously they've gone to bring in a couple of bodies, and we'll see where they fit in. I've actually seen a bit of Davies just from watching Preston, and yeah, it's a bit of a shock that he's suddenly gone to Liverpool. To be honest, you know, like we've sort of Alex Neil sort of liked sort of old school sort of you know, very efficient centre halves who can do a job for them at championship level. So it's a mad jump, but again, like, it shows that they weren't necessarily going to do something rash in this window, and it's more pragmatic. You know, he's 25, he's a good age. It's very likely he may end up just being a squad player there, but it's still life changing for him.
Yeah, for sure. Con and Killarney, by the way, thanks Con for texting in. Hi, the David Luiz sending off, probably the worst sending off decision of the season. Jose was through, Luiz was running behind him. Luiz never challenged for the ball or tackled. As Jose was running, his heel hit off Luiz's knee behind him. He went down, penalty, sending off resulted. Barmy decision, says Con. And then another Kerry man. The people of Kerry really upset on David Luiz's behalf this evening. Michael and Kerry, not his biggest fan, but David Luiz shouldn't have been sent off tonight, lads. Total accident. Penalty was enough punishment. So that is that cleared up. I'm interested in Troy Parrott, Dan. The Troy Parrott situation. Obviously, we've been talking up Troy Parrott, born out of hope and to some degree or other desperation. And we've seen him training with Spurs every day, so surely he's good enough to play for Ireland. He was on loan at Millwall, and that has been ended prematurely. And so he has gone straight out on loan again to Ipswich, which is another drop of a division. 14 appearances for Millwall, started 7 games. I saw Gary Rowett was saying that Parrott worked incredibly hard. He did extra training. He came in on his days off. Sometimes things don't fall for a player, was the Gary Rowett verdict on Troy Parrott's stay at Millwall. So he's dropping down to Ipswich.
Yeah, like, listen, there's no denying that it's disappointing. Really disappointing. Like, I heard great reports about how Parrott had settled in Millwall in pre-season. You know, he apparently made a great impression. And then he got injured before the start of the season, so missed the start of the season, and then come back in and made his debut in a cup game in September and got injured in that game and then missed 2 months. Mm. So he really didn't get going there in the way that they wanted. And listen, we are, no doubt, we are biased in the sense that we are very invested in the development of a young, talented Irish player for all the reasons that you mentioned. But I mentioned this in a piece today. Like, the hype about him was not just Irish. Like, at Millwall, they thought, like, they had signed, this was an absolute coup to get this guy. And, like, their social media activity around Parrott, like, when he came back from injury, like, there was a big build-up of, like, a picture of, look who's here today. It was like, Parrott's here. And I think actually what it almost did was it created a pressure around them that Millwall are actually one of the lowest scoring teams in the championship this season. So by the time Parrott came back in November, I think there was a sense of, well, listen, he's the guy who's going to cure a goal scoring problem. He was going to be brilliant, and he hasn't been around for a couple of months, so here he comes. And he came into it, and I'm not even sure if initially he was really at 100% fitness. He was started off in a central role, but they seemed to lose a bit of faith with him then when he couldn't deliver the goods, and they started to move him out into a sort of a wide area, and it sort of became clear. He didn't actually play a full 90 minutes as much as he made 90 appearances. Made 14 appearances. I think it became clear that Millwall weren't going to play him that much for the rest of the season, or if they were, it might be more on the left side. And as I think his advisors and Spurs and people that are very invested in his development and still believe in him just felt, well, that's a waste of time potentially. And for all parties, let's get him down to Ipswich and hopefully he can play regularly in League One. But look, he's 19 on Thursday. Like, I meant to point to Harry Kane's first loan was 5 goals in 18 games for Leighton Orient. And I'm not saying he's the next Harry Kane, but I'm just saying one bad loan doesn't make a career. But it's obviously, he'll have a certain amount of a pressure on his own shoulders because he is held in that high regard.
Aaron McAniff has gone from Rovers to Hearts for 200 grand. I think you want to make the point Scotland could increasingly become a well-trodden path for League of Ireland players.
Yeah, I think, well, Scotland and actually just, I think England as well, but I think Scotland, I think we've done some stuff, or you've done some stuff around St Mirren on this show, and that they've got Jamie McGrath and Conor McCarthy, two signings from the League of Ireland last winter who've done really well. Now, Aaron McInniff is an excellent player in his own right and probably would have had interest to go away anyway. But I think certainly what we're seeing now is that Brexit has made things very complicated for clubs in the UK for signing, say, the type of second tier players they would sign from Europe because of the work permit regulations. But it's easier for guys to go from here due to the common travel area. We've often talked about Brexit in the 16 to 18 bracket, but I think a thing that's been unseen or not getting as much attention is in the over 18 bracket. You might see a lot more interest in Irish guys because they can't maybe sign players from Europe in the way that they might have. But certainly, I think there's a bit of a fashionable thing too that you found that if a couple of League of Ireland players do well, they come back for more. But McInniff, people at Shamrock Rovers would say his impact wouldn't be far off Jack Burns at all. He's just much lower profile. He was in the Ireland squad in November and he had a year left in his contract and they've cashed in.
Okay, very good. Wish him well. We'll chat to him when he settles in over there. Still 4-0 to Manchester United at home to Southampton. An hour on the clock now. And still Newcastle 1, Crystal Palace 2 at St James's Park. Again, an hour on the clock there. Dan is staying with us and we're talking Barcelona next. One, Barcelona are absolutely broke. And two, Lionel Messi's $555 million four-year contract has been leaked and it's all kicking off. He is planning to sue somebody. There are only four copies of the contract. He has one, Barca have one, La Liga has one, and his law firm has the other. Somebody's leaked it, and we're going to talk to Andy West next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Now, you're very welcome back. Good as always to have you with us this evening. Myself here in studio, Dan McDonald is with us, and we're joined by Andy West from Barcelona. Andy.
Good evening.
Not pretty over there. So it's all kicking off. Atletico Madrid, well, we should remind people, are top of the table and going very well. And Luis Suarez is doing brilliantly. And they're 10 points clear of Barcelona in second and Real Madrid in second. But it's, we'll get on to Barcelona being broke. And we'll tease that out in a moment. But it's Messi's contract leak in El Mundo. His 555 million euro contract leak, which is creating bit of a storm. There are only four copies of the contract, apparently. Messi has one, Barca has one, La Liga has one, and Messi's law firm has one. Who leaked it, Andy?
Well, there's the question. My answer to that would be the former president, Josep Maria Bartomeu, who you will recall was basically forced into resigning a couple of months ago after couple of years at least of very heavy criticism over the way he'd been running the club. And the most vocal critic and the one who probably hurt the most, the criticism, was Messi. This was really came to head in the summer, of course, when Messi wanted to leave. He basically said that the president had lied to him repeatedly. And he repeated that again in December after Bartomeu did finally leave. So there's a lot of bad blood. They've been feuding for a long time. Messi publicly absolutely hammered Bartomeu, who is now out of the picture. He's lying low. But, of course, he had opportunity, as you say, only four copies of it. But there are potential to make photocopies. And Bartomeu, of course, could have done that. Or his associates, not just Bartomeu, the small number of allies that he has remaining, such as Sandro Rosell, the former president. So the widespread belief is that it was, if not from Bartomeu, then from someone very close to him. He's always played the media as well. He's always known how to get the headlines that he's wanted. And he's done it at a time of clearly trying to damage Messi. And I thought it was really telling that it came a day before the transfer window closed. If he'd done it early January, there would have been time, if Messi wanted, for him to react to this by saying, right, I'm going to leave, I'm going to sign a contract now to join PSG, Man City. But by the end of January, of course, the window is closing, so the opportunity to do that is limited. But I think it's really just an act of revenge, put it that simply.
In light of his absence, I'll say that he might, I presume he would strictly deny leaking it. That was good to get a straight answer to that question. I was expecting you to kind of say, I don't know who leaked it. It was interesting.
Well, you asked me a question, I've got to answer it. But he has already denied it.
Okay.
It's so obvious. It's so obvious that he's the prime suspect.
Means and motive.
He's all the reasons in the world, more reasons than anyone else, and also to mess with the potential new president, who is expected to be Joan Laporta, who was the predecessor as president before Rossell, Bartomeu's ally, who fell out. It's all very, very political. Mm. So all sorts of reasons, but he has already denied it. He's been forced to deny it because as soon as everyone saw it was the obvious reaction, well, it must have been Bartomeu.
Messi won't earn the full 555,237,619 euro, but he'll do okay over these 4 years. For instance, things like a renewal bonus accounted for 115 million euro. There was also then a 77 million euro loyalty bonus, which will come in two payments. He'll get 72 million euro in addition to add-on payments for playing more than 60% of games. There are a number of performance-related add-ons, you know, including where Barcelona finish up in the Champions League each year. But like, looking at all the various twists and turns of this contract, he'll go a decent way towards the half a billion over 4 years. So it's a hell of a lot of money. That doesn't surprise anyone, I don't think. And he's always been regarded as one of the wealthiest athletes in the world. But has the El Mundo story, Andy, in light of Barcelona's financial woes, has it sparked any debate as to whether or not Barcelona really are spending their money wisely, this much money wisely on Messi over these 4 years?
It's sparked debate over whether Barca are spending their money wisely, but not on Messi.
Okay.
I haven't seen much suggestion that they shouldn't be paying him that much. Of course he's overpaid. Of course he's a footballer. He does not deserve to be paid 2 million a week. But in the context of him being the greatest footballer of all time and what he means for Barca on and off the pitch, because the amount of commercial revenue that he generates through shirt sales. And I know it's oversimplistic to say that when they sell a shirt with his name on it, the club gets the money, because of course it's tied up in a contract with Nike rather than being directly what they earn. But they've got that contract because they know how many shirts they will sell with his name on it. Mm. All the overseas pre-season tours, all the sponsors. Sponsorships have gone crazy in football in general in the last few years, and at Barcelona. Everything you could sponsor has been sponsored. And it's because they want to be associated with Barca, yes, but with Messi. So he generates a huge amount of revenue for the club. But the widespread reaction has been, yes, they've wasted their money on Coutinho, on Dembélé, on Griezmann, 350 million euros signing those three players. That's where they wasted their money, not on Messi.
Because El Mundo certainly spun this as, well, this is one of the reasons Barcelona's going down the toilet. That was the presentation of the contract.
That was because that's how they were given the contract. You know,
yeah.
You don't just get given a contract and be told, here you are, do what you want with it. It's, I can give you this extremely valuable real estate that will get everyone in the world talking about it as we are now on these conditions. Mm. You run it in this way. This is the angle that you present. Messi's ruining the club. Because, okay, I said it was probably Bartomeu. It might not have been. It might have been someone else. But whoever was doing it, it was to undermine Messi and try to turn Barca fans against him, which, as far as I have seen, has spectacularly failed.
Okay.
But that was the intention.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was the El Mundo only got the report, the contract, on the basis that they would report it that way.
And did I see he's taking, quote, appropriate legal action? I'm not sure what that can be. Really, has the paper done anything wrong?
I'm not a lawyer, but can you print confidential information if it's, even if you've received it? I don't know. I don't know what the legal implications are. They obviously either believe that the El Mundo have acted improperly in printing it, even though nobody has attempted to deny what they've got is true.
Yeah.
So there's no suggestion that they've printed anything that is false, or they believe they can somehow find the source and take the legal action that,
way. Yeah. I suspect El Mundo will argue Barcelona's demise is in the public interest and this is part of it. But either way, we'll see how that all plays out. Dan, before we move on to the general situation at Barcelona, which is not pretty, anything jumping out at you about the Messi contract?
Well, listen, I think we know he can afford to lose the court case, which is what a lot of people, there's reasons why people don't pursue court battles sometimes. I think he can afford. No, listen, I mean, I echo what Andy says there in many respects. Well, his summation of it, but also, I mean, Barcelona losing a lot of money. I'm not sure if they're spending on Messi is where you start. No, I'm interested in hearing more about the reasons behind the broader situation. But like Messi, like football is obscene. Of course, the money that people earn is over the top, etc., etc. But like he's someone who's been doing his stuff for a long period of time, and it's not like it's not a scandal like an Alexis Sanchez contract. You know what I mean, or something like that. So I don't know. It seems like a bad tactic. But whoever employed it to see if it's going to drive things in a particular way. But how Barcelona ended up so broke, that's what I really want to hear, because it's sort of an extraordinary thing if you can run through some of the figures.
It sure is. So, I mean, the short version is they're £1 billion in debt. A 74% of the club's income goes on player wages. That's your fault, Messi, let's be honest. But 74% goes on player wages. They were scrambling, I read over the weekend, Andy, to even get the £220,000 to get Eric Garcia over, whose contract is running down at City, and he was prepared to come. And like, we're talking, you know, in the context of a football club, pennies, like 220 grand is a player's.
And they haven't signed it.
Weekly wage, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I guess to Dan's question, it's one, it looks like it's really bad, but maybe, I don't know, maybe football clubs have the earning power to service a debt like a billion comfortably, but it doesn't seem that way at Barca. So one, it does look really bad, and two, how has it become so bad?
It's been an accumulation over time, and yes, the spending, the figure you gave, 74% of revenue on player wages, is enormous. But it's not just Messi. They've handed out so many long-term, high-paying contracts to players like Jordi Alba, who, not to make him a scapegoat, but to make him an example of a player who was given a contract not so long ago until he's 35. He's now 32. Mm. He's clearly way past his peak, yet they're still tied into paying him for another 3 years at those colossal fees. And it was distorted, yes, partly through Messi, but it would be easy for the club to say we make a special case for Messi because of who he is, and other players would have to accept that. It actually distorted when they signed Neymar and made him the second highest earner at the club before he'd even proved himself, before he'd even played in European football. That led to all the other players around saying, well, if he's got that, then we want that. And that was maybe even more than Messi, going back to when they signed Neymar in, what was it, 2013, that was the catalyst for the massive wages they paid to players. Too much. They paid too much to players. But obviously, Barca have been impacted by COVID more than any other club, probably, because they are fundamentally reliant on tourism more than any other club. The Barca's museum, anyone who's been to Barcelona who's listening will have been to Camp Nou. Many people will have gone on the club tour, the stadium tour, which is expensive, but it's worth it. It's really good. And that is the most visited museum in Barcelona, which is a city of great art and museums. It's got the Picasso Museum, but the Barca Museum was the most visited. So you've taken all that out because obviously there's no visitors for a year. As well as the match tickets, a lot of people who are listening would have gone to Barca and timed it for a game and gone and paid 100 euros for an average seat. That's all gone as well. So they have been impacted more than any other club by COVID, which has pushed them over the edge. But they were already on the edge because of the mismanagement over many years by Bartomeu. Mm. It's really Bartomeu and Rossell, his predecessor, his ally. They were the ones who led the club on the road to ruin.
I must say, I've often wondered from afar about their presidential system. So, as you said, the new vote's going to happen when voting's allowed with the COVID situation. It does, Andy, incentivize short-termism. Like, let's bring in the big names. Often these presidential campaigns are run along those lines. I don't know if, well, I'm going to get the finances in reasonable order and in 10 years' time we'll have a nice serviceable debt is the sexiest of slogans.
No, and it's even happening now. And the name being fought over at the moment is Xavi, with the two main candidates, Victor Font and Joanne Laporta, who, as I mentioned, is a previous president wanting to come back. They're both claiming that Xavi's their man, and the other one says, no, Xavi's my man. No, Xavi, he's with me. No, he's with me. And that's happening now, as he will come back as the next coach.
So if you're Xavi, by the way, your contract's going to be pretty sweet based on that situation.
And if you're Ronald Koeman, you're thinking, well, thanks a lot. Yeah. I'm trying to reshape the team, and the new president's already talking about replacing me. It is short-termism. It's just like politics in, you know, real life. Mm. People chase votes rather than long-term policies.
Dan, have you been to Barcelona?
Yeah, no, I have.
Have you been to the Picasso Museum?
I can't remember if I went to that, but I went to the Camp Nou tour anyway, that's
all
for
I
sure.
To hear.
There you
go.
There you go.
Exactly. Snap, but says me and everybody listening.
It's sort of mad though, like the we sometimes think that TV money will save big clubs from everything, but clearly the longer COVID goes on, it's actually not true. You know, that it's actually some of the clubs are really hurting, you know, and that's a very striking thing.
Andy, before you go, a word on Atletico and Luis Suarez.
Well, Luis Suarez is doing what Luis Suarez has always done, score goals. He's I think he's unfortunate to have been fortunate because he played with Messi, but unfortunate from his individual perception to have played in the same era as Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi, because he would have won two or three Ballon d'Ors. He's a sensational goal scorer, maybe the best number nine we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years. And he's continuing to score goals. And it's no surprise because he remains a brilliant finisher. And the bigger picture is the way Diego Simeone is reshaped Atletico. They have this long-held standing as a defensive team, 4-4-2, defend, clean sheet, maybe nick a 1-0 win. But this year they're playing in a very different way, much more adventurous. He's gone to three at the back, which has enabled him to get an extra attacking player on the field. So they're often starting games with Luis Suarez, João Félix, Marcos Llorente, who's a forward now, Thomas Lemar, all of them playing. And it's great to see, to be honest. They're very refreshing to watch. It's a new Atletico, but they've done it without losing the solidity. So, and when you have Luis Suarez as the centrepiece of the attack, you're going to score goals and win games. And they are absolutely flying, 50 points from 19 games. Very impressive.
Okay. Andy West, always great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.